There's something about spiritual direction that when we experience it, there's a feeling of, oh, this is how I am with people. This is how the Lord is with me. This is what it's like to be attentive in God's presence. I want more of this.
Welcome to Formation Conversations, a podcast of the Spiritual Formation Society of Arizona. We're having an ongoing conversation with friends about what it means to be formed into the image of Christ. Thank you for joining us.
Welcome to the Formation Conversations podcast. It's a podcast of the Spiritual Formation Society of Arizona. I'm Ted Wiesty, the founder and director of the Spiritual Formation Society, and I'm here with my friend, Gray Ewing.
Good to be with you, Ted, and with you, Susan, as well. My name is Gray. I'm the senior pastor at Ascension Church of Phoenix, a Presbyterian church in the heart of our Phoenix. Been here planting this church about 8 years ago. So,
yeah, and it's fun. I walked in here today, and there's just activity going on. There's life at this church. There's new landscaping. There's trees going in. There's a beautiful park you guys have built. It's really neat to watch and see.
Yeah, God's been really good to us in this season. We've had just such a blessing of having a green space here in the middle of the city. Mm-hmm. And that's very rare for Phoenix, and to have a church.
Yeah.
A church
and what an offering to people and an invitation just to come and be refreshed in so many ways, right?
Absolutely. And I'm also meeting for the first time. Susan is joining us today, and we'd love to just hear who you are and what brings you into this conversation today.
And I might want to say a couple of things before, yeah. Okay? I have to say a couple of things about my friend, Susan Curry. You know, we've been doing this podcast. We've kind of reformatted it to where it's Formation Conversations. And mm-hmm. Our heart is that we would just want to have conversations with the people that we love and respect and admire. Not with experts in the field of spiritual formation. Although, Sue, to me, mm-hmm. you are one of the wisest people I know. I wouldn't call you an expert because you would not like that. But I will say that when I met you 13 years ago, and I think you've heard me tell this story, mm-hmm. I met you and I was like, I want to be like her when I grow up. And so Sue Curry, I am grateful that you're able to spend some time with us today. And we would love to just
thank you
a little bit.
That's a beautiful introduction. And I receive it humbly. Just listening to your choice of words, Ted, I'm struck by how the scriptures distinguish between what you said, wisdom and expertise or expert, even wisdom and know-how, wisdom and intelligence. Just wisdom is shaped a long life of listening to the Lord and living in the Lord. And may we all grow in these ways. Mm-hmm. And even, you know, what you just said, like when we first had our first conversation, it was for, as you were exploring the program that we now share together, Sila, I remember that conversation very well. You were leading a church and doing formation ministry within the church. And I came off the conversation and thought, how marvelous that not just an individual wants to be trained in spiritual direction, but there's an entire congregation that supports their pastor growing in the practice of spiritual direction as part of tending the souls of your flock. That vision, I mean, that's what does Eugene Peterson say? A pastor's threefold focus should be, what does he say? Scripture, is it scripture, prayer, and spiritual direction? Are those the three, I think? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so here you are, you too have shaped a ministry of caring about tending souls. That's shepherding. That's pastoring.
I'm sure we're going to hear more about the formation of that as we go along too. But mm-hmm. just real quickly, you mentioned the word Sila and mm-hmm. you referenced Ted. Maybe one or both of you could just speak just for a second about what that is and your roles in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Sila, okay, so fun story. the naming of Sila. Most of you, if you were even thinking, what word is she saying? You know, when you read the Psalms, you come across this word, S-E-L-A-H. No one knows exactly what it means. It seems to connote something of weight is being said, or actually with the Psalms being sung, let's pay attention. It might indicate a pause in the singing, a pause in the music, a pause in the words. We use it to describe spiritual direction, which is itself a pause in just busy go, 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 to stop and pay attention. And it also describes what goes on in spiritual direction, where even in a spiritual direction conversation, when we sense those moments of, oh, wait, the Lord is actually saying something here, we'll invite that pause. So it's a great name for a spiritual direction training program, which is what we're referencing here when we say Sila. The funny thing about the name is simply that when Leadership Transformations, the ministry I work for, when we formed this ministry, this training program, in 2007, we started Sila. I went to a Hebrew professor and I said, I know that biblical Hebrew is no longer a spoken language. Best guess, how would you pronounce this word? And she said, oh, I'd probably say Sila. And I thought to myself, well, I was going to say Selah, but I did ask you, so we're stuck with it. Sila it is. 2 years later, Gray, I was talking with her again and I realized, you know, she's from Australia. And if you ask someone with an Australian accent to say anything that we would pronounce A, it comes out E. So who knows what she was saying or how she meant to pronounce it. We've called it Sila ever since.
I think it's whatever you say with confidence is the proper way to do it, right?
There you go. That's right. And it sets us apart. It distinguishes us.
I always assumed that Sila was the term for a guitar solo in the Psalms.
There you go. Spoken by a guitarist.
Here's a little musical break and a little solo action. No, I'm just kidding.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
What's your connection to Sila then?
So I was trained in the program. Sue was referencing that initial interview that we did 13 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then, it was a transforming, life-changing experience. And I think I came away from it, really probably in the middle of it, thinking, I want to share this with other people. Mm-hmm. And at that time, Sila was just on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. And so I began to talk to Sue and say, any thoughts about doing something on the West Coast, Arizona? And so, we began to pray and seek the Lord's leading. And so we started a cohort, Sila West,
we started the first Sila West cohort in 2015 and just graduated our ninth, cohort from Sila West, which is wonderful. Yeah, out there in the desert.
Well, speaking of pauses, part of our podcast is that we want to take some space to pause. And our tradition has been that we do that with some sort of snack or drink that is appropriate in some way, you know. We brought some things. But Sue, what have you brought? What's your...
Yes, well, I have seated down next to me a teapot and a cup into which I will pour a cup of tea. I did forget to bring my milk. Years ago, my husband and I spent 3 years in Scotland and became tea drinkers during that time. Tea with milk, always with milk. And there are huge debates on whether you put the milk in first or the milk in last. My husband asks people, are you pre-lactarian or post-lactarian? And that leads to all kinds of fun conversations. So I have tea and shortbread, which is a classic Scottish refreshment.
I love it.
Sounds amazing. And with the last name Ewing, you know, that's my heritage as well. So
yeah,
we love tea and Scotland, though I've never been there. I'd love to go one day. Ted, I'm going to turn it over to you because you brought us snacks.
Okay, I did. So I got us a couple of things. First of all, I got us some pumpkin spice lattes.
Oh, surely it's fall.
Yeah. And part of the reason was I was thinking about something that's appropriate to the time of year. And now, you know, all this stuff comes out and it's not feeling very fallish here. And I have to admit that I've never had a pumpkin spice latte. This is my first one. So, Yeah, I've always kind of been... I'm a bit of a contrarian. I don't know if you know that, Sue. Like everybody's doing it. I don't want to have a pumpkin spice latte because that's what everybody's doing. So I'm kind of giving in and having this latte. And then we got a couple of sandwiches from our pockets from Starbucks. One's a spicy falafel pocket. The other one is a jalapeno chicken pocket because it's lunchtime for us. So
yeah, my goodness. All right. I will enjoy my tea and shortbread and you enjoy your trendy pumpkin spice latte.
Absolutely. And friends, we'll see you on the other side of this break.
How was that? How was that pumpkin spice latte?
Well, you know what? It's been a long time since I had a pumpkin spice latte, and it was very good. Here's my rules about pumpkin. You know, pumpkin is amazing and has a place. I have about four or five pumpkin things per fall season. I don't get on the hype train, you know? Uh-huh. I love it every time I have it, but I'm always worried that it's going to be too much. And people that are all about it do bother me a little bit, to be honest. and it's funny that you got that today too, because yeah, obviously in Phoenix this is not really a fall season. We actually have our fall fest at church in mid-November.
Which nice. Is
funny because we have a fall fest, we do a neighborhood event. Yeah. We do it in mid-November, so it actually feels like fall, which is most people's winter has already started. But I'm of the opinion that we should always will the fall into existence here in Phoenix. So by dressing in flannel or by ordering pumpkin spice latte, you know, it's almost an act of prayer. We're asking the Lord, please make it true in Phoenix as it is in heaven.
And there you go. And dressing in flannel in Arizona in September actually feels like an ascetical practice.
I know that's like an act of faith.
That's right. Well,
to wear flannel.
This is a podcast about faith.
That's right. Who needs a hair shirt? I've got a flannel one.
But we had the pockets as well. Yeah. And what did you think, Ted, of the pockets?
Great. I'll have that again.
Yeah, absolutely. I had the falafel one and it was really good.
Yeah. Spicy jalapeno was mine. It had a little bit of spice, but not too much. It didn't burn. You know, they don't have it that spicy. And then the latte, I would drink this again, but I would probably, there's other lattes I would still rather have, but I think my fear, part of it is my contrarian nature. I'm not going to just jump on the hype train, but part of my fear was it would taste like super pumpkin-y, and it's not, it's just, it's got enough little in there, you know? So
very nice. Yeah. Very nice. Well, you know, I love that you start, like you have this tradition of taking a break to have your refreshment. And that's the thing, when I first encountered at least the way I experienced tea, sort of a British, overall British tradition. We were in South Africa. My husband and I were in South Africa back in the mid-1980s and staying at a Christian retreat center. And the entire retreat center took a break at, I think it was 10:30-ish in the morning, met in the main dining room area and had tea and cookies together. Mm-hmm. And then they all went back to their desks. And I thought, my goodness. And there's the retreat center we use now in Scotland, a monastery, a group of monks. And at 10:30 every morning, they stop whatever they're doing. They gather in the refectory and they pour cups of tea and sit down and chat about how's the morning going. They have their tea and their biscuit, and then they go back to work. And it struck me, you know, the way I work, the way we work in America is we've got our little coffee cups and we sit them on the little warming pads and we sip from them all morning long and power through. Mm-hmm. And how refreshing to actually take, it's a Sabbath practice in the middle of a morning, in the middle of an afternoon, just take a break.
That's beautiful.
So beautiful.
Yeah. I feel like we can just continue to learn so much from other cultures. When you're saying that about Africa, I remember being in Sudan, so far up north. But every day we would stop. I was teaching a class at a Bible kind of institute, and every morning we would stop for tea.
Yeah,
with, you know, hot tea with milk in it. It was so good.
Yeah.
And then every day at lunch afterwards, there would be a break, and I would go take a nap for like, and then we'd come back and finish the day of teaching. But those kind of rhythms, they're just,
we don't have rituals like that. Yeah, the mid morning, mid afternoon. But it just makes so much sense, you know.
It really does, yeah.
Especially that afternoon slump and, you know.
Yeah. So, and I'm even thinking here, you know, monastically, there's the hours, practicing the hours. So the stopping for worship multiple times a day and thinking of our food refreshment is the same way. We stop, we pause, we reorient ourselves. Here's who God is. Here's who I am. Recollect ourselves in the day. and then step back in.
Sila, there it is.
Yep, there it is.
Yeah, it's the rhythm of our physical bodies. And yet, how often do we just grab something to eat and have it at our desk?
Yeah,
Or standing up somewhere in the car.
Yeah, yeah. I like these reflections.
Yeah.
Meditational.
So tell us, just if someone says to you, Sue, tell us a little bit about you.
Generally, I start with, I guess, in family. If this is a who are you, I would naturally say I am a beloved daughter of God, a child of God. Within that, I have the great blessing of a loving and stable and grace-filled family. I grew up with just marvelous parents and a brother who is a dear soul who has needs in life, needs to be sort of help navigating life. And he lives with my husband and me. He has for the last 10 years, but a dear man. My husband is amazing. I say who I am is because of his love and his prayers through the last 43 years now of marriage. We have three children who are now in their, not even young adults anymore. They're all in their 30s, and three grandchildren. And my work as a parent when my children got into their 20s was that hard work of realizing, you know, when they're born and you hold them in your arms, as I do now with my three grandchildren. Did you know that, Ted? I have a third that our youngest just had a baby last week. So yes, now I have three.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah. Three granddaughters. You know, you hold a little baby in your arms and you're like, you know what you're praying for them, who you want them to grow into. You name them with something in mind, with their name. And then you raise them and you shape them. And that's your calling as a parent, is to form this child. And then they become young adults and you look and realize, who are you? To a certain extent, right? Who are you? And so the adjustment for me in their 20s was letting them, I think I was pretty good at giving them space to become themselves, but the learning to see them for who they are and then to like them for who they are, and then to actually be grateful for who they are. That's a process. And it's all about really setting aside my own expectations and seeing them as God sees them, for how he sees them, and letting my prayers become his prayers for them. Mm. Or letting his prayers become my prayers is maybe a better way of saying it. So I've always wanted time as a family gathered together, and I still very much do, but it's truly enjoyable, just a delight to see the Lord's goodness extended relationally like that. I am, I think the word grace means a lot to me, and people would describe me as gentle and gracious and probably other words as well, but I think the word grace means so much because as a firstborn in a family of only two children, where the younger one needed more care, what became a false self-identity was that, oh, I'm the one you can count on. I will do things right. And that soon becomes almost a self-righteous identity. So for me, learning to receive grace unmerited, not because I'm good at things, not because I'm the responsible one, just because the Lord loves me and I can release all of that firstborn stuff, is a deep experience of grace. And it's the grace that I want to be able to live in and extend to others. So I think that's a big part of it. I am generally a quiet person. I am a pretty strong introvert. I get pretty desperate for time alone if I haven't had it. I learned early in our marriage, as the wife of a pastor at that time, in that season of life, my husband was a pastor. Now he works with a seminary, but training pastors. But I learned early on how to do the extroverted thing. I can survive any coffee hour. I come home afterwards and I'm utterly exhausted. So contemplative rhythms, I think, have long attracted me, long before I knew the word contemplative. I didn't grow up with spiritual formation as a phrase, as a thing. I grew up in the area when discipleship was the primary model of church life. I'm still deeply committed to that, but I would say a formation model is much more of my natural gifting and calling. So those are bits of who I am.
Well, you know, Sue, how do you encapsulate who someone is with just right. a question? But thank you for sharing those things, because I know relationships and family are mm-hmm. at the core of your heart. And one of the things I know about you, and I tell people this often, I probably told you, Gray, you are one of the most gracious, strong leaders that I've ever served with. Truly a great leader is one of the things I really appreciate about you. And so I'm wondering if you could share a little bit about how, serving in the church, mm-hmm. Dave is a pastor, your learning rhythms and how to, serve well in that. What was the journey of moving into like becoming a spiritual director and,
And thank you for asking. Interestingly, years ago I heard a woman politician here in Massachusetts interviewed, and she was running for state office. So there are, I don't know, 100 and some state representatives in Massachusetts, and she was one of, I think, 8 women or something like that at the time. And the interviewer asked her, "Only 8 of you are women, like what's that all about?" And she said, okay, huge blanket statement, but she said, men like will wake up in their early 20s and say, "I think I'll be a politician," and then they make it happen. And women wait to be asked and need to be asked multiple times. So thank you just even for using the word leader when I didn't use it in my own self-description. That is a gift, and I receive it as such. Thank you. I think it's people who have voice and power who need to create the space for others to be recognized, and I appreciate that. I never thought of myself as having leadership gifts when I was growing up. In college, Christian Fellowship, my sophomore year, the leaders of the fellowship came to me and invited me into a leadership position, so I started experiencing leadership opportunities then. I did not have any particular sense of calling in my life. And I knew once I started dating my husband early in college, he was called to be a pastor. Okay, I'm along for the ride. Soon after we were married, I very clearly sensed from the Lord an invitation to go to seminary and study Christian education. And it was a very specific, it was the most specific thing I've ever heard from the Lord. So I did, and then we began our post-seminary ministry life in campus ministry, working for a church. And then I enjoyed that very much. From there, we moved to Scotland for my husband's graduate studies, came back to the U.S. and planted a church. So in a church plant, as you know, Gray, everything needs to be done, and it's all hands on deck with the few who are there to help you start out. And so as the pastor's wife, I did a lot of things. And about 5 or 6 years in to that church plant, I heard about spiritual direction. A friend invited me to a conference on spiritual direction. So I went to the conference and I thought, that's sort of cool. Maybe I should have a spiritual director. So I wrote a letter. Email was just coming into being then, but I typed a letter and mailed it off to the woman who was my first spiritual director and asked if she would take me on as a directee. And, I laid out my theology just to make sure we'd be a good match. And she said, "Sure, Sue, let's give it a try." And a few minutes into our very first one-on-one conversation together, I realized, this spiritual direction thing, this is who I am. This is how I am when I have conversations with people. So at her encouragement, I started exploring being trained. It took a while to find a program that matched me, that I felt was just, I could be free and theologically and just a fit. And as I began that training, I was just simultaneously my ministry at the church, which had been volunteers, the pastor's wife, was finding more and more of a focus in what we would all now call spiritual formation. Mm-hmm. I found particular joy, not only in offering one-on-one spiritual direction, but in leading retreats. And again, the way I first led a retreat, this is so classic for what I was saying about women needing to be asked. I organized a team to plan a retreat, and one of the other women on the team said, well, I'll lead it, Sue, if you help me out. So I thought, okay, I can do that. We got within 3 weeks of the retreat, and she said to me, oh, I didn't mean I'd teach. I just thought like I'd organize. I thought you'd do all the teaching. So all of a sudden, on the fly, I had to pull together teaching and lead this retreat that went beautifully. And I did it in what we would now call formational ways. So it's not a conference, you know, not talk after talk and workshop after workshop, but a talk, time for reflection in silence, time for small group processing, really very prayerfully held. And as I was doing that, I thought, oh, I love doing this. And I think I'm called, this is the kind of thing I'm called to. Oh, yes, Lord, this is what you called me to all those years ago. So it just developed from there. Soon after that, we moved to New England again for my husband's job, but waiting for me here at the seminary where my husband is was Steve Macchia, who heads up Leadership Transformations, and he met me and he said, come help out with some of what we're doing at Leadership Transformations. And Sila was born, you know, a year later, what would you love to do, Sue, if you could do more? And I said, I'd love to train directors. So that's when we started praying into what Sila would look like. It does feel to me, and I find this when I interview people for Sila, there's something about spiritual direction that when we experience it, there's a feeling of, oh, this is how I am with people. This is how the Lord is with me. This is what it's like to be attentive in God's presence. I want more of this. And that's very much how I experienced it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
You mentioned the feeling of this aligns or this makes sense or this feels right mm-hmm. in your own story, and then noticing that in interviewing other potential directors. What I'm curious, because a lot of people that listen to this are in spiritual direction, and some mm-hmm. of them are spiritual directors, some of them are not. If someone were discerning, mm-hmm. am I called to spiritual direction to be a leader in this, to go mm-hmm. to a CELA program or something like that? Having interviewed now, I'm guessing dozens, hundreds, maybe people, like what do you notice about the type of person that is generally called to this? Whether that's a skill set or if it's a stage of life or a spiritual imprint or whatever it may be.
Yeah, great question. And I'll begin by countering a misperception. So anyone listening to me right now thinks, okay, if I have to sound like that or be like that, I guess it's not for me. A good spiritual director is not necessarily an introvert. Some of our best directors that Ted and I know. Well, first of all, Ted, you're an extrovert, right? So Some of the best directors we know are energized people who step into a room and there's a buzz around them, and you know they're winsome, energetic, high energy people. So lay that misconception to rest.
You don't have to speak in a whisper to be right. to be a spiritual director. Yeah. Okay.
Exactly. Yeah, so how do you discern a call to direction? Well, you should have experience of people coming to you with their own spiritual life, the stuff of the life of their soul, and sharing that with you, just speaking it in conversation. Whether you've been trained or not, you'll be receiving conversations like that. And in spiritual direction training, we finesse how do we hold that conversation in the presence of God and try and keep our attention on God? How do we refrain from intruding with our own? In Sila, we talk about holy self-restraint. We all have giftings in companioning other people, those of us who are called to this, but we restrain ourselves from responding out of those giftings. So I might be a great counselor. I'm not going to step into the conversation with counseling advice. I might be a great discipler. I'm not going to step in with suggestions for how the person can grow. I might have gifts of healing prayer. I'm not going to turn the session into a healing prayer session. So we restrain from responding from those gifts, but the gifts help us pay attention to what's going on. as the director, the spiritual directing, whatever's going on between them and the Lord, and just helping their attention stay as directly as possible with the Lord. We talk about keeping their attention, the directee's attention, vertical rather than diluting it horizontally by them having to engage a lot with us.
Mm-hmm. So probably someone that's teachable in those ways, then it's not.
Yeah.
I can imagine. Yeah. Disciple's disciple, pastor's pastor, you know, mm-hmm. counselor's counsel. And that can be kind of a hard switch, I'm sure, for some people to switch into that mode of just that active.
It's a hard switch, honestly, for everybody. And we actually have started jokingly calling our initial training period not an orientation residency, but a disorientation residency, because it is disorienting to realize this is not about what I say. And I don't have to be sitting here thinking of the perfect way to respond. I'm holding, I just like to say, we are offering, protecting, and nurturing the directee's presence to God.
I always love it when someone who's in training gets that they can't do it wrong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because there's such an impulse to, oh, I've got to get this right. How exactly do I get someone to listen to God or whatever? And to make that shift to, I'm offering space,
mm-hmm.
but God is the one who speaks and works. And it's such a, it's like a turn that happens and a shift. And it's, and for some, it happens fairly quickly. For some, it takes a year and a half. And
that's right.
That's part of why it's a 2-year program, because it takes time to live into these ways and to move from normal ways of relating mm-hmm. to this companioning kind of way. So
yeah.
I will say, as someone who's not a spiritual director, but has been in direction for 9 years, that's a hard shift for the directee as well, right? Which is like,
yes.
I've told this story, I think, on the podcast before, but my first year, I brought my backpack into my sessions.
Uh-huh.
Because my work bag or whatever, like I was coming from work and I always was reading things and just had pursued life intellectually and very much like, oh, this spiritual direction is something I need to learn about, you know, now. And I remember the day that I left my backpack in the truck, you know, like there's nothing to record. There's nothing to write down and like follow up with later, or I don't need my work stuff. You know, I just need to be, you know, present to the moment. And that shift is hard for the person who's sitting across from the director as well. And maybe even, you know, in my case, it wasn't the case because my director is so loving and present with me and just amazing, but there is maybe even a sense of disappointment or loss. Like, is this like a real thing? Is it a good thing? Is it worth my time? You know?
Right. Right.
It takes a while to get to that kind of that where it's like, I'm not looking for a specific payoff. It's in the practice itself that I'm learning a new way of being. And
that's right. That's right. Exactly. That's really well said. Yeah. Thank you. I also think it's important to clarify, in case anyone, another misperception. At its best, spiritual direction is part of the life of the church. And by that, I don't mean that every congregation should be highlighting a spiritual direction ministry. But when a church is offering rich and full ministry, when they're doing good discipleship, when you have sound preaching and nurturing worship, godly community, when those things are happening, there's a lot for a directee to work with. And a lot that a directee then can bring into a completely separate meeting with their spiritual director and be processing in that setting. It's a quiet, set apart, first deeply personal ministry, but it's not an individualistic ministry.
Mm. And in many ways, like all the spiritual practices, mm-hmm. one of the criticisms is that it's navel gazing or it's just individualistic or whatever, but if engaged well, they will always lead to
that's right
to going out into the world, into the church, whatever.
Yeah, kingdom fruit for the sake of the church.
Mm-hmm. So I think we use the phrase or said it this way, that spiritual direction is a practice. It's a spiritual mm-hmm. practice that we give ourselves to, the same way that we would give ourselves to prayer or reading the scriptures or worship, those kind of things. Mm-hmm. So What is someone missing if they aren't engaging in spiritual direction?
Theoretically, they're not missing a lot if they are, on their own, a deeply reflective person and have relational contexts where they can be processing their life with the Lord. I do think what spiritual direction offers is a person whose entire attention for that hour you're together is focused on prayerfully holding you in the presence of God. I don't know where else we get that, with that kind of intentionality and focus of attention. I also just read a beautiful, I read a book this summer, my husband and I led a retreat on it, by Evelyn Underhill. The book is called Concerning the Inner Life, and she talks about four rhythms to nurture in our prayer life. And when she gets to the fourth rhythm, the first three are about nurturing our inner life with God. And then the fourth is how we bring that into our ministry. She wrote this book for ministry leaders, for clergy, 100 or so years ago, just about 100 years ago. And in talking about how we bring this into our ministry, she says it's a ministry of intercession, and she uses that word intercession in a large understanding, not simply praying for someone, but the intercession of going into your space, your church building, when no one's there, and praying for your people in the space. That's part of intercession. You're just praying for the presence. So you're going between your people and God in this space where they meet. And then second, our specific understanding of intercession, praying for people in your flock. And the third she gives attention to is spiritual direction. And she says the most important thing we can do as spiritual directors is pray for our people. More important even than when we're sitting and talking with them. And she says, if we're doing this well and simply hold, and not praying necessarily a lot with a lot of words, but just holding them in the presence of God, she says, if we're doing this well, those who are paying attention will get an awareness that we're doing this. They'll realize I'm being prayed for. And that happens with me, with my director. I realize she's praying for me, both when we're meeting and, you know, when we start a call the next month, I realize she's been praying for me, not because she says this is what I'm praying for, but there's just that awareness in the spirit of this person has been holding me in the presence of God, and God has been at work in me because of that.
Going back to something you said, Sue, do you prefer Sue or Susan?
Either one is fine. Okay. Don't try Susie. My father-in-law was the only one who got away with that.
Okay.
It doesn't fit me very well.
I've heard it both ways, and even in this conversation. So you mentioned about your upbringing and about the false self that feel like you had to move out of in terms of being the responsible one. And that resonated a lot with me. I'm a functional firstborn as well. I have an older sister, but kind of same scenario. And that's one of those things that's been part of my journey as well. What are some of those things that you're noticing, like in direction and with others? Like, you know, as a preacher, one of the things that I was trained in is finding a technical term called the fallen condition focus, right? Which is like, okay, where does the fall affect this person that you're thinking of as you're preaching to them? And how does the truth of the scripture apply to that part of the fall? Basically, is kind of one of the ways that you think about addressing. If you were to think about a fallen condition focus, like if you were thinking about like, who is the type of person that's struggling so much, or what are they struggling with that, that you think spiritual direction gives the best remedy for, coming out of the false self, one of those things, what else are you looking at as a director, the types of things that people are struggling with that this really helps with?
Perhaps the foundational condition is one of intimacy with God. So whatever our particular struggles, our sin patterns, our self-image, God meets us and does his work in us as we let him in. And our view of God, our experience of, is God truly safe? Is he trustworthy? Does he love me? Can I dare open myself to him. Those are some of the foundational. It's not until we really open our, God does not force himself. He's absolutely sovereign. He does not force himself. So even for me to ask the question, what are my sin patterns? What's my false self? That's a hugely threatening question. And I only dare explore that with God as I experience him as leaning towards me and desiring me and desiring my response towards him. Mm. Ted has done a beautiful teaching on the Song of Songs and that relationship between the lover and beloved and the, whichever one you're calling which, but the woman in that song starts out with a very low self-image. She talks about how she's darkened by the sun and her brothers ignore her or mistreat her or something. I forget the details. How dare you look at me? And all he does is love her. He just keeps expressing love towards her through the whole poem. That's how God is with us. And in spiritual direction, when we experience another person sitting with us in love, not with an agenda for us, the only agenda of the director is the love of God, for this person to grow in intimacy with God. Mm-hmm. To experience someone sitting with me with that as their hope and their prayer and their presence, it may take a long time. I have directees who I've been with for years, and they're still, can I trust this, right? And a lot of that depends on our human experience of being loved that way. But that is the work that God does in us over time.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Yeah. I've asked a couple of people that question before, and it gets similar responses. Intimacy and belovedness seem mm-hmm. to be the biggest desires that is met by, you know, spiritual direction. And it's amazing yeah. how much we can read passages mm-hmm. of scripture and it doesn't stick, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
The love doesn't seem to stick. The challenges stick. The calls to reform and the feelings of weight and shame.
Yeah.
Those stick easy. Yeah. The belovedness yeah. doesn't seem to stick, and you yeah. know, stay with it until it does.
That's right. That's right. And then it becomes the starting point, the entire context and the starting point for growth in obedience, growth in faithfulness.
Well, one of the things that we have started doing over the last year, I guess, is ending with a question that has become a lot of fun to ask and hear the responses. But Sue, if you could go back and talk to your 25-year-old self, mm-hmm. what would you say to 25-year-old Susan Curry?
I would say what I think I only began to learn a few years after that, and I didn't even realize it at the time. Being with people and loving them the way God loves them is more important than any program you can lead, any teaching you can give. I don't want to overstate it. I don't want to say those things aren't important. I do those things. But the 25-year-old me thought that's where my identity was. That's where those were my gifts. That was what I had to offer, was teaching and organizing and leading programs. And the 85-year-old me, if I live that long, will not be doing those things. And I will still be of great value to the Lord, and I pray have something to offer his people. I met with a directee recently, and she was describing sitting in her garden. She's around my age, a little bit older maybe, sitting in her garden recently, looking out, and she could see how it had grown over the last 20 years with her tending. And she sat there and she loved what she saw. And she said, if I could say, so it's so funny you asked that question, because she said, if I could take some of these like young people in their 20s and say to them, tend your garden so that you can later enjoy it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. 25-year-old Susan, tend your garden. Don't worry about what you're not getting to because you're stuck at home raising this little baby. That was me at 25. tend your garden and you will enjoy it with the Lord for eternity.
Mm. Thank you. Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you for the things you shared earlier about what it was like having kids in their 20s and the shift that happened that now they're in their 30s. Because as you know, I have two kids in their 20s. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the reasons I'm asking this question is for them as well. So thank you for your wisdom. And when we're in our 20s, we're building a life. Mm-hmm. We're building what will be. And so often we are well past that. We're thinking about all these other things, and to just be rooted and tending. I love that imagery. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. I will credit my husband who did plant a church in his starting in his late 20s. And, you know, this first couple of years, you just think, is this baby going to live? You know, will this thing survive? And all along, he said, the Lord has not called me to be successful. He's called me to be faithful. And I think that's it. Be faithful. Don't worry about productivity or accomplishment. Be faithful. Become fruitful.
Thank you, Dave Curry.
Yes. For a lot of things.
Yeah. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, this has really been a rich time. Thank you, Susan, for your time and sharing with us. How can people learn about you or Sila or direct us on how?
Thank you. Thank you, Gray. Well, easiest, ask Ted directly, and he'll be delighted to direct you. Leadership Transformations, if you do www.leadershiptransformations, put an S at the end, .org. That's the overall ministry. And within that ministry, one of the programs offered is Sila. That'll tell you almost everything you need to know. And then you can talk to Ted, talk to me, talk to someone who's been through. Our graduates are listed there as well. Find a director there. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I wanted to share, I wanted to give you the opportunity to share about, there's a lot of stuff going on with the Spiritual Formation Society.
Oh, well. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I want to say about Sila, though, I'm not exactly sure when people will be listening to this podcast, but we're recording it early September. And so we start receiving applications for the cohort that'll start in March of 2026. We start receiving those applications later this month. Mm-hmm. So if that's something that's of interest, you can inquire, submit an application. That's coming up. And we do interviews and receive applications through the fall. And it's been a joy for the Spiritual Formation Society of Arizona to really partner with Sila, not in a formal way necessarily, but certainly walking side by side as friends and colleagues in ministry. And one of the things on our website is we have a listing of spiritual directors. And I was thinking, I think it's about 50, and I counted it today, and it's 50. We have 50
nice.
On there, which is great. I'm number 50. By the way,
right?
Because my name comes
what,
at the end.
Skill ranking or what?
Well, yeah.
Reverse order.
I'm down at the bottom, so you know, no one ever find me. But we have 50, and I thought about also you might check out some of our new partner communities in Washington, the Ozarks, and Texas. And they don't necessarily have directories up yet, but as you get connected with them, if you're in one of those areas, they will be having directories and that kind of thing soon. And those websites are pretty easy. Ours is sfsaz.org. Those websites are sfswa.org. You can figure out which that one is. Yeah.
Okay.
sfsoz.org, the Ozarks, and then sfstx for Texas. And Texas already thinks they're the biggest one around.
Of course.
So.
Of course. and Ozarks,
humble.
For the uninitiated, the Ozarks include Arkansas, and mostly, right? Is that where it's based? Or
yeah, in Northwest Arkansas.
Yeah. Plus maybe Missouri or something.
Yeah, the Ozarks go up into Missouri. So
okay, very cool.
Yeah, so check out any of those websites as well. And at sfsaz.org, you'll find information about coming retreats and workshops, as well as our annual conference coming up in February.
Wonderful.
Thank you, friends, for joining us on this episode. And thank you, Susan, for giving us your time.
Great to be with you all. Blessings.